In April and May at Hillcrest Church in Austin, we held a special series of interviews. We called our event the Neighboring Faiths Interviews. We invited the leaders of four major religions to come for an interview regarding their faith background. I got a chance to build friendship with a Jewish rabbi and a Muslim imam, a Hindu priest, and a Buddhist monk. Now, you likely work with Hindu co-workers or have a Muslim family on your street, or your kids play soccer with kids from Jewish families. And the whole reason for our interview series was to help us learn to be two things at once, good neighbors and good communicators in our diverse city. We're to be good neighbors. Everything I read in Scripture tells me that I am to seek my neighbor's good, and I'm to seek his good regardless of whether he converts to Christianity or even wants to hear about it. So I'm to be a good neighbor, but at the same time, I'm to be a good communicator. Opportunities often arise in our relationships with others to explain how Jesus can be our forgiver and leader. So, good neighbors, good communicators, that's who we're supposed to be, not just one or the other, but both at the same time. And neither is possible without understanding. You know, I read that the Chinese written character for wisdom is made up of two Chinese characters, one an image of a large ear and the other a small mouth. Don't you love that? Wisdom comes from listening more than yakking, in other words. Well, our Neighboring Faiths interviews were all about learning to have a big ear and a small mouth. The event wasn't meant to be a time of debate. It was meant to be a time of listening, all for the hope that we can be better neighbors and better communicators. At the end of the following interview, pay attention. There are some resources that I'm going to recommend to help you learn more about other faiths. And these materials will also help you communicate your faith in Jesus when an opportunity arises. Thanks for your interest in the Neighboring Faiths interviews. I read something from historian Arnold Toynbee, who predicted in the near future would be marked by what he called the interpenetration of Buddhism and Christianity, and sociologist Stephen Warner projects that it will become increasingly difficult to distinguish Christians from Buddhists. I thought that was an interesting way of sort of introducing our program tonight. I think it's very important for us to be familiar with all of the neighboring faiths that we've been looking at across the last several weeks. And I think that this one is important as well. One of the reasons that I'm... One of the reasons that I think that it's so wonderful to be able to introduce David to you is that David is a Western convert to Buddhism, and perhaps many of the Buddhists that we have an opportunity to run into here in Austin will themselves be persons who were raised with some sort of Christian background, or at least maybe an introductory Christian background or something like that. If you have some folks from maybe more of an Asian background, Asian immigrants to the U.S., they may have been raised Buddhist, but that's not necessarily the case for a number of our neighbors who have found the principles of Buddhism very interesting. And so I want you to welcome to our gathering tonight David Zuniga. Now, David is, like I said, well, tell us about your decision to embrace Buddhism and to get trained in a Korean Buddhist order as a priest.
That's a great question. And I just want to say, too, thanks for having me here to your lovely church. And just on a quick interfaith note, I'm just so glad we're doing like this. The United States is an incredibly diverse society, and I think it's really important that we learn to listen to each other and respect each other and work together and get along. But in reference to your good question, Tom, you were asking about me becoming Buddhist and what led to my getting ordained. In a nutshell, I've always been interested in religion. I was raised in a pretty traditional conservative culture. I was born in 1970. My dad... Actually, it was during the Vietnam War when my parents got married, and he actually wanted to join the Marines during Vietnam and actually finished grad school early to go into the military. And my mom was like, no, you can't go into the Marines. That's too dangerous. So then he became a fighter pilot. So that's just to say that I had a pretty typical I grew up in Virginia, which we also think of as the South, and pretty much lived on military bases all my childhood years. My dad was in the Navy for 20 years, went to Catholic schools for grade school, middle school, and high school. So I think as a child, I was always kind of inspired by religion, the power of religion. I took very seriously the questions that religion asks and the answers that religion tries to find. I do think some of me coming to Buddhism was just kind of the causes and conditions of my life. My dad was a career Navy man. He's traveled to over 100 countries. He would write me letters from all over the world from the time I was a baby. And so I was always interested in other cultures. I've always been into sports, and I got into the martial arts, and that was kind of my first taste with traditional Korean culture and meditation. I will say, too, because this is a long question for me to answer, so to try and boil it down, I think the key was I was raised in a very active Christian house, and went to Catholic schools, and there's a lot I think I still retain about my Catholicism and my Christianity, but as for me personally, the beliefs that most resonated with my mind, with my values, with just kind of my way of being in the world, was Buddhism. And I think I always had there's this term in Buddhism, bodhicitta, which kind of means this desire to serve other people. And I think that bodhicitta that I have now that we talk about in Buddhism, I've heard some of my Christian minister friends refer to it as the light. But this kind of grace that is within you or that comes from outside of you that moves you to want to help other people, I think I've had that all my life. And I think I owe a lot of that to my parents, and I also owe a lot of that to my traditional religious upbringing. But I think the thing about Buddhism is, for me, it was kind of the thing that literally made me the best dad, the best husband, the best friend, the happiest. And it was the thing that could, for me, most authentically help me experience and live and understand the world in which we're in.
Now, you went to Korea, or you were invited to Korea. This was kind of a rare thing for a Westerner to have that opportunity, right?
Yes. I was ordained in the Taego lineage, just like in Christianity. You kind of have three overarching denominations of Christianity, Roman Catholicism, Orthodox Christianity, you know, like Greek, Armenian Orthodox, and all the different Protestant denominations. In Buddhism, too, you have Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana. And within those three, it's kind of like you might have Baptist, but you have American Baptist, Southern Baptist. You might have Zen Buddhist, which is what I am, but you have Japanese, Korean, Vietnamese, and Chinese Buddhism. And then within those, lots of different kinds of Buddhism. I was the first Westerner ordained as a priest in the Taego lineage. And I went to Harvard Divinity School, specifically because I wanted to study Buddhist-Christian dialogue. And while I was there, I befriended a monk named Ilmi Sanim, who's also in my lineage, and we just got to know each other really well. I went in 2001 and did a extensive practice period in 2001. Moved down. I'm not from Texas, but I got here as fast as I could. Graduated in 2002, literally as fast as I could. I graduated on June 9th, and we were here by the 14th, so that was pretty quick. And I was working as an interfaith chaplain for Seton for a couple years, and then in 2005, I went back to South Korea and was ordained.
And they gave you an honorary name, an honorary title. I've always, as we've interacted, referred to you as David. The name is...
hard to pronounce in English.
So help me out with it.
Sure. Dale Sanim is the
Dale
full.
Dale Sanim.
Yeah.
Which means?
Dale is, I guess they don't do that in a lot of Protestant churches. See, I do think my familiarity with Christianity is still more Catholic-based. You'll forgive me for going to Catholic schools all my life. But in Catholic, when you get ordained, in Catholicism, I think you get an ordination name too. Dale is the Korean term for the Sanskrit term Vairochana. In the mythology of Buddhism, you have all these different bodhisattvas and Buddhas, and it's kind of embarrassing to say, but Vairochana, or Dael in Korean, is the Buddha of the sun, the primordial main Buddha. Mm-hmm. So one of my friends I got ordained with said, "Ah, Dale, you have a big name."
Yeah.
So, and then Sanim is what all Korean monks are called. It translates into English as Venerable One or Holy One, but it's like Sensei or Lama or Rabbi, okay. Teacher.
Okay. I think one of the best ways to sort of jump into this subject is, it's not the definitive way of understanding Buddhism, but a good introduction is if you could just give us a quick recap of Gautama Buddha's life, And, you know, of course, the Four Noble Truths, which are probably the most familiar thing I think anybody who's been introduced to Buddhism would know. So
yeah.
Help us with that.
Great question. Siddhartha Gautama, according to the history of Buddhism, lived roughly 2,500 years ago in kind of northeast India, what we would now actually be part of Nepal. And in the mythology of Buddhism, the Buddha was this very rich prince. And it was kind of a prophecy when he was born that he would, his life would go one of two ways. Either he would become a great king, a great worldly leader, or he would become a great religious teacher. And his dad, the king, wanted him to become like him and become a ruler of people, a king. What actually happened in the Buddha's life, it said that he had this great wisdom and this great insight, and he'd always lived a very sheltered life. And his dad didn't want him to encounter any suffering so that he would pursue a more kind of material existence. The Buddha knew there was something more to life, so one day he kind of snuck out of the palace walls, and he had what we what are called the four great visions. At first he encountered an elderly person, and then he encountered a sick person, and then he encountered a person who had just died. And then he was very forlorn. And that might sound kind of odd, right? Because we all kind of know about suffering and death. We all know we get older. We all know we have suffering in our lives and sickness, and we all know we eventually die. But at the same time, I think that resonates with me in my own heart because, one, we tend to be kind of death-denying as a society. Two, most people in our society don't really think about these things. And three, I know I can. Probably all of you, even if you, when you were a little kid, you could remember the first time that you encountered death, or the first time a loved one was terminally ill, or they got a chronic diagnosis and that was a really scary thing. Just like in Christianity, there's so many beautiful examples of the Buddha's life, or Jesus's life, so too in Buddhism. There's all these kind of psychological events that we can really relate to on a heart level. And so the Buddha, like all of us, he was devastated at seeing death. He was devastated at seeing suffering. And I think when you see that kind of suffering, it can open your heart up. It can make you really want to follow the religious path.
Do everything you can to transform the suffering of other people's lives. And that's what the Buddha did. He was
sad and very despondent. And then, as the story goes, he looked up and kind of silhouetted by the moon was a monk meditating in the distance. And that was where the Buddha kind of had his aha moment and led him to the spiritual life. And the Four Noble Truths are kind of a bedrock of Buddhism. They're easy to misinterpret. But the Four Noble Truths, in essence, are the first one is life is suffering. Two is suffering comes from desire. The third noble truth is
desire can overcome. And the fourth
noble truth is the means to overcome that suffering. It's
very interesting if you think about how the four noble truths are kind of formulated. They're actually constructed intentionally in the formulation of ancient Indian medicine, the Vedic design. In other words, the first noble truth,
life is suffering.
Yeah, that's kind of a diagnosis. This is the human condition. Life is suffering. We'll talk more about that. Because it's not meant to be kind of an existential downer. Quite the opposite, actually.
Life is suffering. That's kind of a diagnosis of the problem.
Number two, suffering comes from desire. That's the etymology. Suffering. What is it called? Psychology, psychiatry, cultural studies, philosophy, all the different disciplines have different answers. The Buddha said suffering comes from desire. And that needs to be unpacked, too. But
number three is the prognosis.
Like,
life is suffering. Some suffering comes from
desire.
Wow, that sounds like a pretty grim prognosis, doctor. What does that mean? And the Buddha says, well, the good news is your suffering can be cured. Your suffering can be transformed. So that's kind of the prognosis. Like, it might be a tough course of action, but we can get through it and you're going to be okay. And then the fourth noble truth is what's really called the Eightfold Path. But it's basically the treatment plan, the way to overcome your suffering. And if I could just take a minute to kind of elaborate on that. Suffering comes from desire. What does that mean? Does that mean desire's a bad thing? No. It comes down to your intentionality. What is your intention for doing what you're trying to do? That's the key. And it's not that desire is a bad thing. I have lots of desires. Like today, I had some delicious jalapeno chips, which I like. You know, we all have desires and things that we like. But that's actually a good metaphor for suffering in the human condition. And I don't mean to be flippant when I say this, but it's kind of a good metaphor, like chips. Like, I really love chips and queso, and I love jalapeno chips. But if I cling to those chips too much, I might eat too much, and then I might get sick, or I might get overweight, or have bad health, or something like that. Or if I cling to those chips too much, I'll be sad when those chips are gone. Which is a real experience. That's the thing. So suffering, in a nutshell, it doesn't mean that you don't experience things. To live is to feel pain. In fact, I think that the more you live, in some ways, the more pain, and even the more happy you are, in some ways, the more pain you will encounter. There's a great lay Buddhist teacher and therapist, Sherry Huber. She has this expression: suffering is optional, pain is inevitable. I think that's so on the mark, and that kind of cuts to the heart of Buddhism. Suffering is optional. Pain is inevitable. And what that kind of articulates what we're talking about with the Four Noble Truths. You will experience pain, great pain. Suffering is when you get stuck, when you get trapped in this inexorable cycle from which you cannot get out, and you engage in things that just make you descend in that vortex even more. That's what the Buddha is talking about. And so when we say suffering comes from desire, when you cling to things that are going to inevitably change, whether it is your, you know, chips or anything else in life, things change. And so in Buddhism, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to cultivate equanimity against the kind of endless ebb and flow, the tides, the vagaries of existence as they exist.
Okay. Now, in Zen Buddhism, particularly, I imagine this is a tradition in other forms of Buddhism as well, but in Zen Buddhism, meditation plays a huge role. In fact, that may be one of the more familiar aspects of Zen Buddhism for many people. What does meditation do for you absorbing the Four Noble Truths, you know, making them a part of your life? I imagine that's the reason for meditation is to think deeply about these things. Is that right?
Absolutely. I would say, just to put a finer point, to think about them, but really to experience them. Okay. To give an analogy, there's this great psychiatrist, Viktor Frankl. He wrote this incredible book, Man's Search for Meaning. He survived the Holocaust. And in it, he says, Frankl's theory was that a person who has a meaning in their life, a value, a belief, they can endure anything. Mm-hmm. Nietzsche said the same thing. A man who has a why to live can endure anyhow. From a Zen perspective, we'd actually say, that's very nice, but that's not quite right. You need a practice. You need something. And I've really found this in my work in end-of-life care to be true. I've spent the bulk of my career working as an interfaith chaplain. People, whether they're Muslim, Christian, Jewish, Hindu, you can have beliefs, and beliefs are very good. I'm not putting beliefs down, but you need a practice to make those beliefs a lived, experienced reality in your heart. Does that make sense? I think practice, and see, you're seeing the Zen bias, because Zen is really big on the practice, the discipline. But I really believe in my heart that's true. As an analogy, it's kind of like you can say, well, I'm going to run the Austin Marathon. But if you don't have a training plan, and you don't stick to that plan, you're not going to run the marathon no matter how much you believe. And I think that's true in religion as well. I'm not putting down beliefs. I'm absolutely not. But whatever, you can believe in emptiness. You can believe in, you know, traditional Christology or the Quran. You need something that makes those beliefs a lived, experiential reality in your life. So for meditation, I'd say it does a couple things for me. One, it definitely calms me down, and it makes me a happier Dave. And it, you know, sometimes, like, if the kids are, probably most people in here are parents, we're a little older to be having children. We have a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old. And sometimes children are great, and they can be a little testing of your patience every so often. You know, so my wife would be like, Dave, you need to go meditate for 5 minutes. And, so there is that benefit. But the biggest benefit is, the biggest benefit is that meditation, it makes all these kind of philosophical ideas of Buddhism a lived experiential reality. And I think a lot of Westerners, especially Westerners who are interested in Buddhism, they're always, that's where they kind of miss the boat. They're really interested in Buddhist philosophy, and I like Buddhist philosophy too, but I don't think Buddhist philosophy is the key. The meditation, the practice, the discipline, that is the key.
I open with some quotes or comments from an historian and a sociologist that talked about the fact that there would be a tremendous amount of interaction between Christianity and Buddhism, at least in the Western world, in the future. And I think, to a certain degree, that future is already here, and in places like Austin and in other settings. And of course, there's a great deal of interaction, between the ideas of Christianity and the ideas of Buddhism. And there's some significant differences, too. And I think that's something that we've looked at and discovered across the other interviews as well, that there are some points of commonality and some points of differences as well. One of the things that I wanted to do that I thought would help kind of gain a better understanding is it seems to me that at the least there are four sort of working assumptions under the Four Noble Truths, under the understanding of Buddhism. I hear what you say about, in fact, I heard somebody say that, in Buddhism, you don't necessarily refer to Buddhists so much as believers as practitioners, and that with you highlighting, what you had just said about the fact that this is a practice, more so than a belief system. And yet there are certain assumptions or certain beliefs that if they're not there, then the efficacy, the impact of the Four Noble Truths perhaps aren't there as well. I think one is the, as you and I were dialoguing back and forth, I was struggling for the right way of phrasing this, but perhaps the irrelevance of the God question, and we'll talk about that. The idea that the impermanence of all things, including the impermanence of the self, the fact that craving is a problem, you've already touched on that, we'll touch on that a little bit more. And the idea of karma and reincarnation, which this gathering got a chance to get introduced to a little bit last week when we were looking at Hinduism. So let's start with that one. And of course, if there's a better way of saying it than irrelevance, then we will, because I don't mean that as a flippant sort of thing. But as I understand, the Buddha, the historical Buddha, was not terribly interested in what would be regarded as, in his mind, speculative questions as to the existence of God, non-existence of God. I read one story where he said, if you were shot by a poisoned arrow, you wouldn't have a debate about who shot you, how tall he was he dark-skinned, light-skinned, you'd pull the poisoned arrow out. He said, that's what my work is all about. Is that a pretty good way of sort of speaking about it?
That is a fair way. There's all different kinds of Buddhism, just like Christianity. And the oldest Buddhist scriptures, our Old Testament, if you will, is what's called the Pali Canon. And Pali is just a dialect of Sanskrit. And so it's the idea that after the Buddha died, his followers, and you see this in Christianity too, his followers all got together and they said, what did the Buddha say? And they tried to write it down. That's the Pali Canon. And then as Buddhism moved to other parts of Asia, they came up with other scriptures. But that's the oldest. There is a place in the Pali Canon, actually twice, and it's called, I guess, the 14 Great Questions. And they're questions like, is there an eternal life? Is there a soul that exists after we die? All those kind of things. And in each one, the Buddha is silent, and his silence indicates in the text, it says, and the Buddha says this directly, he says, those are not questions of the religious path. That's very interesting, because there we see a radically different recasting of what we mean by the religious path than I think most of us in the West are used to. The Buddha said very clearly, I teach one thing and one thing only, cessation and the suffering of cessation, or the end of the cessation of suffering. I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the cessation of suffering. And so Buddhism, there is this way from the ancient Buddhist scriptures that you can argue that Buddhism is a practice and a philosophy around relieving people's suffering. And I think that's one reason why in like psychology, psychiatry, mental health, Buddhism is a very popular way to do psychological interventions, because there is this, I think, philosophical and practical dimension to it. And within the tradition, I wouldn't say that God is irrelevant, because that has a harsh term, like you were saying. But there's definitely, within the tradition, I would say that idea comes from a couple things. What scholars might use the term non-theistic. For example, you're theistic, there's many different understandings of God, but theism is kind of a basic overview of how a lot of Westerners would think about God. Agnosticism means you don't know if God exists. Atheism means you believe God does not exist. Polytheistic would be about multiple gods. Non-theistic is how Buddhism is often described. Non-theistic. And that doesn't mean Buddhism is saying there's no God. It's saying the question of God is not a focus of Buddhist practice. And I guess a couple reasons for that. In Zen, there's this very, very famous saying, which I find helpful in my own spiritual life, and I'll explain why. But in Zen, there's this saying, and you can even see this in classic, especially East Asian art. They'll say that words are a finger pointing at the moon, but they are not the moon itself. That's very interesting, isn't it? That's kind of a modern, Western, you know, postmodern rhetorical sensibility. But what that's saying, and I think there's a lot of truth in this, let me give you an example. So my wife and I have two children. We've also had three miscarriages, to be really candid. You and I had talked about that. No poet, no writer, no philosopher, no psychologist or psychiatrist, the world's most brilliant person, I don't care how great a writer he or she is, could never fully define definitively all the joy that goes into having a child, or all the fear that goes into sometimes having a child, you know, or all the sadness of a child dying. And yet, the reality is, my friends, and I'm not being flippant when I say this, children are born and children are dying, just like adults, every day. And if words are imperfect players, if words can't even define something that happens every single day, that is an empirical reality that we know to be true, from a Zen philosophical perspective, words are ultimately limited. And so Zen, as much as possible, tries to avoid even using words or text or language. And that, in fact, that was one of the definers of Zen, one of the ways Zen tried to differentiate itself even from other forms of Buddhism, is that Zen is not a religion based on sacred words, texts, or concepts. So when we say Buddhism is non-theistic, it's not that we're trying to be disrespectful or mean-spirited. I was raised Christian. I can certainly, I think, understand psychologically why people would want to be Christian. And I can tell you, as an interfaith chaplain, who's held the hands of many Christians, you know, who were losing a loved one or who were dying themselves, Christianity is a beautiful religion, and I can understand why people believe in God. I think from a Zen perspective, two things. One, there's this idea, words are just a finger pointing at the moon. Words are not ultimate reality. And so sometimes if we try and capture ultimate reality in words, we're just going to miss the boat even more. The second thing is, and this will get into our discussion of no self, but it's sometimes said in the in classic Buddhism that for people who believed in a self, the Buddha said no self. For people who did not believe in a self, the Buddha said self. And part of that is because the Buddha is trying to instill within us an equanimity regardless of what's going on around us. It's kind of like our mind is like the ocean. On the surface of the ocean, there's choppy waters and there's storm and lightning and all kinds of debris and all this kind of stuff. But underneath the surface, the ocean is deep and calm and still and abiding. And so the Buddha was trying to have us be that way too, have equanimity regardless of what's going on. And the thing about, from a Buddhist perspective, the idea of theism is that it can become this incredibly complicated belief system, and it can become a vehicle for attachment or delusion, making mistakes instead of just pulling the arrow out and dealing with suffering and transforming suffering. And that's not to be a critique or debate. But
right.
Yeah.
And I was going to say the same thing that, I mean, in reply, you know, I would not, because this wasn't designed to be sort of this debate, and for that matter, you know, the simple existence of God is not nearly important enough for any Christian. I mean, loyalty to God, adherence to God, understanding God, that's the most important. And yet, I'm, as you know, as I the more, you know, I look into Buddhism, the more I look into what the Buddha and his followers down through the years have taught, it seems to me that non-theism may not be a sufficient way of describing it. In other words, I mean, the Buddhist worldview is that everything is in a state of flux. There is therefore nothing outside of that state of impermanence and flux, which therefore automatically renders, you know, God I mean, it renders us not just agnostic toward the idea of God. It's impossible, you know, to believe at least in the God that is revealed in Scripture, a God who's permanent, a God who is unchanging, a God who's beyond this state of impermanence and flux that we have going on. And so I'm not sure if agnosticism or non-theism is because I think invariably, you know, if you're embracing Buddhism, you're embracing a worldview that says there is no room for a permanent God in a place of total impermanence. I guess also, you know, the idea of the poison arrow going into you, and well, the point is to pull it out. The point isn't to sort of argue about whether he was tall or dark-skinned or light-skinned or that kind of thing. And it seems to me, well, yeah, but if I keep getting hit with this arrow, somewhere along the way I have to go, have I stepped on somebody's property here? You know what I'm saying? Maybe I need to pay attention. Am I insulting somebody in this land that I've moved into? In other words, I think all of a sudden it becomes important to ask the question, who shot this arrow and why is he mad at me? You know? And so I think that's an important consideration, at least from my perspective. I think, though, that one thing that in terms of Buddhism around the world, like you said, different forms of Buddhism and all. And, of course, Buddhism around the world is probably replete with divinities. I mean, a multiplicity of Buddhas and bodhisattvas, is that how it's pronounced?
Uh-huh, yeah.
I love Stephen Prothero. You and I were talking earlier about him. Boston University professor's recently written a book called God Is Not One. And in it he said, I love this line. He said, the earliest forms of Buddhism did not speak of God or stress the supernatural. They saw the Buddha as a human figure. It wouldn't be very Buddhist of Buddhism to remain forever the same, however. And it did not, as a child of India. And he goes on to say all of the sort of developments of Buddhism from that point. Last week we looked at what was known as bhakti-style Hinduism, kind of a very devotional, popular form of Hinduism. And I'd say that probably a lot of people who are traveling in Asia would very quickly run across persons who do kind of appeal to Buddha or one Buddha or another in prayer, you know, asking for assistance and asking for help. I mean, that's not your approach to Buddhism, but
yeah, it's a great question. It's a fair one. There's absolutely devotional practices within Buddhism, and there is this. I think in some ways, any religion or any philosophy comes down to this. It's kind of like Soren Kierkegaard talked about, like empiricism. Science is based on what we know, gathering empirical data, demonstrable truths. A lot of religion is defined. Kierkegaard talked about taking a leap of faith, going into this chasm where you do not fully know. And that's the idea of faith. There is that in Buddhism as well. I'll give you an example that articulates this kind of well. So I was the first Westerner ordained in my particular lineage of Zen. There's other Zen, you know, other forms of Buddhism, other Westerners ordained before me. But in the Taego lineage, which is one of the two main lineages of Zen in Korea, I was the first. And so I went through this kind of very old school, traditional Asian way of ordination, which I don't think they have in the West, and very few Westerners have done. But it was a lot of what you'd call ascetic practice, a lot of sleep deprivation, fasting, physical exertion, that kind of thing. And it was incredible training. But it was also the very kind of traditional Asian style of Zen training. And one of my teachers said to me one night, he said, "Ah, David, your training is so hard. You're the first Westerner doing this. I'm going to pray for you." And he had said that to me a couple times. And I said, "Well, Saneem, when you pray for me, what does that mean? Who are you praying to?" And he kind of caught himself, you know, and he kind of said, "Oh, you're right." You know, and it wasn't that I was critiquing him, but I was sincerely asking him because, and I think this illustrates the tension. On the one hand, so there's this text in the Pali Canon, the Mahapari Nibbana Sutta, which my wife likes to say 10 times fast. It's a little game we have, but because it's hard to pronounce. But the Mahapari Nibbana Sutta, it's the story of the Buddha's death. It's kind of our version of the passion story. And there's this, you know, everybody knows the Buddha's dying. They're all gathered around the teacher, asking him questions on the right way to do things right before he dies. And so one of them says, "Should we have devotional practices?" And the Buddha actually says no. He says, "That's lesser stuff, you know?" And then one of his students is like, "But it helps people." And the Buddha says, you're right. Okay. For me, that illustrates a couple things. One, it illustrates that the Buddha wasn't always right, that he was a human being, and that he was open to reason. And that's very important for me in the way I approach religion, because I don't think anybody is infallible. I think we should all be open. We should all be open to the possibility that we are wrong, myself included. Two, again, it's this central idea in Buddhism, do what works. So the Buddha was kind of saying, no, let's not have devotional practices. And then one of his students said, it helps people. And he said, you're right, it does help people. Okay. And so you can definitely make an argument based on the traditional Buddhist scriptures that devotional practices, these kind of Kierkegaardian leaps of faith are not called for in Buddhism. You're on firm footing, you know, and that's why you could be agnostic or atheist and be a Buddhist. You could also be a Christian and be a Buddhist. But at the same time, I think it is true across cultures that for many people, and I could say this as a grad student in psychology, people do have a desire for belief. Many people have that. And so you'll see that manifested in Buddhism.
Yeah. And I think that's important. I might be able to mention at this point, you know, all four nights, I don't think that any of us, and whatever faith background you're coming from, the majority of us here are part of this congregation, but whatever faith background you're coming from, I don't think any of us can make an assumption that because we've read a book or attended a one-hour seminar or something like this that we understand Buddhism or Islam or Christianity. How is the person you're interacting with in your office dealing with it? This is getting to be annoying right here. Let me fix this. So how are people in your office, how are people in your workplace interacting with their beliefs? Winfried Corjan, who wrote the book Neighboring Faiths, and that's the title from which we get this series, you know, he said something interesting. He said, nothing infuriates a knowledgeable Buddhist more than asserting that Buddhists worship the Buddha as God, yet on the level of lay people, this is precisely what takes place, and a lay person may not be embarrassed to tell you so. And so, you know, as you had said, I mean, even from, you know, the sort of the closing lines of the historical Buddhist life, there may be, I guess you could call them two traditions that have sort of developed out from that. I remember years ago, this was years ago, watching the Academy Awards, and the man that played the Buddhist man that played in The Killing Fields, and of course, I mean, how many of us have seen in the award show when somebody comes up and, you know, of course, make sure to thank God or something like that for, you know, the success that they've had. So this is stuck in my mind because all these years down the line, because as he came up and he received his Academy Award and he said, I'd like to thank Buddha, you know, for what I've achieved here. And so there is, I think, a devotional aspect to a lot of popular Buddhism as
That's
well
true.
As a more philosophical approach that, you know, that someone, particularly from Zen Buddhism, would have. I understand Zen Buddhism probably has more of a deliberate sort of separating from. Buddha is regarded very much as a man who was simply a way shower, somebody who pointed the way. If it wasn't him, it would have been somebody else who did that. Is that right in Zen Buddhism?
Correct. Yeah. In a lot of ways, Buddhism from within the tradition, even from its days in ancient India, it did have a lot of kind of scientific trappings and underpinnings to it. And the Buddha, the analogy is often given, it's kind of like, I don't know, so now I'm showing my scientific ignorance. Who's the scientist, the apple falls on his head?
Newton.
Yeah. Isaac Newton, or wasn't it one
Steve
of our founding...
Jobs.
About the founding... Benjamin Franklin, right? Or,
okay.
No, I'm an English major, so anyways. But the idea is, you know, even the guy who discovers gravity, you know, it's not like he owns gravity. If he hadn't discovered gravity, someone else would have discovered
it. Right.
Same in Buddhism.
Now, another assumption that I see is the idea of the impermanence of all things, including the self. Now, my goodness, we could spend the rest of the night on this and perhaps still be struggling with the issue as we conclude. But, you know, coming from a Christian perspective, there is the acknowledgement that there are impermanent things, but not the impermanence of all things. I mean, there's this well-known passage in Hebrews, for example, chapter 12, which says that God will, you know, once again shake the earth, and it says that, you know, to reveal that which cannot be shaken, you know. And so after the shaking of things which can be shaken is done, that which cannot be shaken is still there. And because we are inheriting a kingdom that cannot be shaken, you know, we thank God. And so there's clearly in Christian understanding of things that are impermanent, but then things that are
permanent. Mm-hmm. Buddhism, there is nothing in the category of that which is permanent, including the self, right?
Correct.
To help us understand that.
Good question. I think it gets misunderstood sometimes. Buddhism, especially by Westerners, will be seen as nihilistic or life-denying. It's not that we don't exist. Like, of course we exist. You know, I'm 5'7". I live in South Austin. I love chips and queso, you know? So of course we exist, but it's this kind of idea in Buddhism, especially Zen, you'll hear this idea of the two truths. And so the two truths are kind of these different levels of reality or understanding. On the one hand is the kind of conventional truth, everyday, day-to-day existence. And so in a sense, I do have a self. You know, I'm 5'7", I'm 40 years old, I work at Hospice Austin, you know, I'm married with two kids. I have a self, and we have rights, and we have responsibilities and obligations to the other citizenry of our society, all those kind of things. On an ultimate level, no, I do not exist. This is a way that Buddhism grew out of Hinduism, by the way. It's kind of like, you could say in a way that of the three traditions of Abraham, you know, Islam grew out of Christianity, which grew out of Judaism. In ancient Hinduism, you had this idea of an Atman, which basically means soul or self. And that soul continues from life to life to life to life to life. The Buddha came along and he put it in a prefix in front of an Atman, or Atman, and he said, Anatman. So the Buddha was saying literally, no self or no soul. Now again, of course you exist. We all exist. But we don't exist in a fixed, discrete, distinct, autonomous, individual way. We are all interconnected. We all exist together. It's kind of like existence, from a Buddhist perspective, is we exist, but the bounds between self and other are much more permeable and much more interconnected than I think some other philosophies or religions would say. And I find that really life-affirming, actually. I find it tremendously liberating. And one way I'll tell you that I find it liberating, Albert Einstein was speaking at the graveside of another physicist, and to paraphrase what he said, Albert Einstein said that I feel so interconnected with every being in the universe that I fear not the passing of any single being, including myself. And that's the way I feel. And that's what meditation gives me, by the way. You have to have the practice so you can realize the idea. But when I hear the idea no self, I actually think of it as an expansion of the self. Another way to kind of contrast that with theistic religions of the West in a general comparison would be that you might have this idea of a husband and a wife, or a believer and God. And like that believer, so I'll give my the idea of no self from a Western perspective. Like, I could love my wife. We have kids, a house, you know, two cars, lots of fun. You know, but my wife is still my wife, and I am still me. You know, I may love God, worship God, praise God, go to church every Sunday, be a good disciple, but God is still God, and I am still me. In Buddhism, we would say all things exist together. We all exist together. And that I find that just really life-fulfilling. And so I love the idea of no self. And I love it even more experientially, I should say. But that would be the idea in a nutshell.
Yeah. The related to that is another assumption, and that is the idea that to crave or to desire is the way that we remain attached to a world that is impermanent. And so craving or desire being the fundamental thing that has to be overcome in order to achieve nirvana. Can you tell us about that?
Sure, it's a great question. And a big one. But
Yeah. And I might say that this is an area where there is a lot of similarity. I think Christians are starting and ending at a different point than Buddhists are with that, but there's some overlap in the importance of the danger of craving or the danger of clinging to that which is impermanent. So let's spend some time with that.
Well, and you'll definitely... Okay, so I have to confess my bias up front, right? I'm a Buddhist priest, so I have my biases. But there is this way. I had this professor at Harvard, Robert Gemello, and who was a scholar of Buddhism, but a devout Catholic, I believe, in his person. I know he's Christian. I want to say Catholic. But to quote Rob Jamello, who's a great scholar of comparative religion, you know, and Robert Jamello was not Buddhist in his personal life. Mm-hmm. But he said, you know, the Buddhist idea of suffering makes sense. And that's not to bias you, but there is something I think that most people can agree on this when we talk about craving and attachment. There's this idea in Buddhism. It's kind of like we have three interrelated states. You might have heard this term monkey mind. It's kind of like our mind, it's kind of a classic Asian image that a monkey jumps from tree to tree to tree to tree. It's always looking for like safety or shelter or warmth or shade or water or a coconut. But this idea of this monkey always jumping around, and it can never find solace. It can never be still. It can never simply exist. That's the way our mind tends to be. According to classic Buddhist philosophy, our mind tends to vacillate between one of three stages. Clinging or attachment, aversion, pushing things away, or ignoring. In other words, we cling to things that we like. Like we could say, oh, I really like chips and queso, you know, or I... A couple of months ago.
You didn't eat before you came here
tonight. I didn't, actually. How could you tell?
This is the fourth time you brought that up.
Am I really? Yeah. See, I'm clinging. And it's causing me suffering. We cling to things that we like. And we don't want those things to ever change. But everything changes. Or we have aversion. We push things away. We want to say, oh, I don't want the world to be this way. But the world is this way. Or we tend to tune things out that we don't like. And you know, it's interesting because there's actually been a lot of psychologists who've done research on this. People's minds tend to ruminate over the same things day after day after day. You know, so if you don't like your boss, most likely you think about not liking your boss a lot, you know, or if you don't like a politician or your neighbor or whatever it is, credit card debt, whatever is going on. Most people psychologically tend to fixate on their problems over and over and over and over again. This is one of the things the Buddha was talking about. Clinging, aversion, and ignoring. Tuning out. And when we do that, we suffer. One, we're not facing reality directly as it is, and so we're blocking out information that we could use to deal directly with the problem. Two, we're just getting stuck in the situation and we're not doing anything to fix it. Let me give you an example. So I've worked in end-of-life healthcare as an interfaith chaplain. You can have two people, and there's no judgments here, just looking at the situation directly. You can have two people with the exact same diagnosis. They could both be terminally ill. Have the exact same circumstance. One person will be overwhelmed, filled with depression and fear, and maybe have a lot of negative mental things going on, you know, anger and, you know, all this kind of stuff, and they turn away from people. The other person, it's like they never fully lived until they got diagnosed with being terminally ill. Their heart opens up, their love grows deeper, their faith grows deeper, their relationships with their family grow deeper. In other words, from a Buddhist perspective, we don't think suffering is in an event itself. It is what we bring to the event through our mental states.
I would say in my study of this and the visits that you and I have had, this is probably, and there may be some others too, the more I look into it, but this is probably one of the most helpful aspects of looking into this idea of craving or desire. Yeah. And clinging to that which is ultimately not permanent. Like I said, I think that we may have come at it from a different starting point and have a different conclusion. But this, I think, is a very important point. I think that one of the things that would mark a Christian's approach to this as opposed to a Buddhist approach to this is that, you know, a Christian would probably say, instead of the problem being craving or desire toward impermanent things, our problem is failure to crave or desire that which is permanent. You know, mm-hmm. And again, in a Buddhist perspective, there is no such thing that falls in that category. But you know, you read the Psalms of David in the Old Testament, and over again, here's a guy who craves. Here's a guy who longs. He's thirsty, but he's thirsty after what we would say is the right things. You know, oh God, you are my God. Earnestly I desire you. My heart longs for you. You know, and I would say that the Christian answer, the Buddhist answer, probably is somewhat different along those lines. We both agree that we get into so much trouble by clinging to that which is not permanent.
Yeah.
But Christianity would say, but there are, there are some permanent realities. Ultimately, God and His kingdom. Whereas Buddhism would say, there isn't anything that falls into that category, I would think.
Yeah, Buddhism would definitely, in general, say that, everything is impermanent, everything is changing. One thing I do want to say, too, is I think sometimes people misunderstand Buddhism. So I talk about, craving and attachment. And to give one other example to illustrate that, so I just gotten back from Asia in 2005, and I was in my truck, and I was heading up north, or maybe it was 2006, because I was going to Hospice Austin, and I was going up, who I work for now, and I was going up Mopac, and I was stuck in traffic. It was like 8:30 in the morning, and you guys know what it's like to be on Mopac at 8:30 in the morning, stuck in traffic, pouring rain, I'm going to be late. And I started to have an attachment, and I could just watch my mind unfolding, and I was like, oh, I'm stuck in traffic. Why are all these drivers here? I need to be there. Of course, I'm one of the drivers too, right? And then all of a sudden, it was like my mind just switched. I thought, wait a minute, I'm just sitting here. I could still see, the downtown, I've just crossed over Town Lake, and I can see the UT Tower and all the Frost Bank and all these buildings lit up and kind of silhouetted by the lights and, the night sky, and I'm listening to John Coltrane. Wow. I'm just sitting here looking at the skyline and listening to some classic jazz. This is great. So it's this idea that we have attachments and that causes suffering. We get stuck on things and it causes suffering. It doesn't mean we don't have passion, though. You can read the classic Buddhist scriptures, and the Buddha said, I will reach enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings, or I will die trying. So it's not that we don't find joy. It's not that we don't work very hard for a cause. It's that we try to have equanimity regardless of how things unfold. But that doesn't mean we're okay with the status quo or anything like that.
One of the things that I mentioned in our last visit together that I wanted to touch on, because it's an area that that I really struggled with when I was studying the Buddha's life, as much as there is there to admire, one of the things I really struggled with was his departure from his wife and baby son in order to find enlightenment and becoming the awakened one or the enlightened one. He did not, in fact, return to them. It was almost as if, in order to find enlightenment, I have to leave behind these attachments. And I struggle with this.
Yeah.
Christianity, of course, does teach that the pursuit of God and loyalty to God is primary to everything else. That only in America would we use the word priorities as plural. There's one priority, our pursuit of God. Everything else is secondary. And yet, you have this beautiful image of Jesus as he's dying on the cross, turns to the Apostle John and to his mother and says, Mother, behold your son. Son, behold your mother. In other words, he's kind of handing off that responsibility that he has had for her at that point. And of course, plenty of scriptures in the New Testament that speak about our obligation to our families and to our connection. And so, disrespect. And I know that coming from Zen Buddhism, you look upon the Buddha as a very human figure who had strengths, had weaknesses, and that kind of thing. So, but I struggle with it.
Yeah.
You and I talked about that the last time that we were visiting. In fact, I was watching the PBS documentary on the Buddha, and that documentary, some of the Buddhists who were speaking in that one even said that, he referred to his son as fetter. And I thought, oh my goodness, I'm struggling with this.
Yeah, that's actually a mistranslation.
Okay, good. But I'm relieved to hear that.
Right. Yeah, his son was named Rahula. And Pali, which was the language of the historical Buddha, the oldest Buddhist scriptures, is a dialect of Sanskrit. But it's a dead language. No one speaks it anymore. Okay. And so scholars go back and they try and reconstruct it pretty much just from these Pali texts. And so it was thought for a long time that Rahula meant fetter or chain. But now scholars think it actually means moon. So I don't know how we interpret that, actually.
Yeah.
But I will say there is this story in Buddhist mythology that the Buddha was married, that his wife was pregnant, and they had a son. Shortly after that, the Buddha left the palace walls, left his wife and child, to go reach enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. And I will say that, too, because there is this idea that he wasn't going, leaving his wife and child to, go drink and party or
right.
something like
right.
that. He was trying to cultivate a universal humanity or a universal love for all of humanity? I think a couple things. One, no, I'm not advocating deadbeat dads or people leave their kids or anything like that. Absolutely. I mean, I'm a father and a husband. I'm not advocating that.
And that's very clear in our conversations with each other.
Yeah. Thank you. One, I do think we have to keep in mind the cultural context. In India, 2,500 years ago, it was actually very normative that if there was a married couple and they were extremely wealthy and the wife was extremely well provided for and would be okay financially, that her husband would go off to follow a spiritual path. That was kind of their cultural norm in India 2,500 years ago. So whereas we look at that and we're taught to say, you know, never leave your wife and child. And I agree with that. In their cultural context, it made a whole lot more sense. And his wife was a princess, and, you know, she was financially well taken care of, too. The other thing, too, that does get neglected a little bit is that, at least in the text that I'm familiar with, his wife would do all the, you know, same practices that the Buddha would do. And it was said that his wife reached enlightenment and was ordained as a nun, and then his son reached, you know, was ordained as a monk and was enlightened too. So actually, not to be flippant, but I do think of it a little bit as like the Fred Astaire Ginger Rogers debate, like who's better, Ginger Rogers, because she does it backwards. You know, the Buddha's wife did the same thing in the temple walls.
Yeah, in the context of family.
Right. Yeah. But yeah. So I do think some of it is just a different cultural context.
Yeah.
And then too, there's this idea, at least in texts I've read, where the Buddha was always friends with his wife, always kept in touch with her, that kind of thing.
Those of you here for the first time tonight, I mean, I think it's pretty clear, but we've had opportunities to meet several times. It was very important to me that any question that was important to me would be shared ahead of time, so there's nothing that, you know, I intend to spring on anybody at this point. And that was something that you and I talked about. I said, you know, honestly, I'm struggling with this.
Yeah, that's a good question.
And so I appreciate you sharing what you did there. You know, the last assumption that I see in Buddhism is the idea of reincarnation and karma. Now, we got introduced to that last week when we were looking into Hinduism. And just to reiterate real quickly, in the Abrahamic faiths, Judaism and Islam and Christianity, history is linear. Act 1, Act 2, Act 3. There's a beginning, there's a middle, there's an end. And the more Eastern faiths of Hinduism and Buddhism, it's more cyclical, with the idea that there's a kind of a continuing a cycle of birth and death and rebirth and reentry back. In fact, it's reentry back into existence that is the problem to deal with. It may not be perhaps as explicit in Buddhism as it is in Hinduism, at least from some of the things that I've read. But still, that's the problem. You find yourself in existence where suffering is going on, and the intent is to not find yourself entering back into existence again.
Yes.
Sort of the way of understanding. It's a little different because of the idea of no self, so you don't have a soul, a self, that's sort of picking up where you left off.
A literal...
Is that right?
Yeah, a literal fixed continuity.
Right.
Yes. It's sometimes said that in Hinduism you have this idea of reincarnation. Mm-hmm. The same soul or self goes from life to life to life to life to life. Whereas in Buddhism you have the idea of rebirth. Now this is actually a little of the like kind of more subtle points of Buddhist philosophy. But yes, you have this idea of rebirth, that some manifestations of consciousness might continue from life to life to life, but not a fixed, discrete, distinct, autonomous self. The other way of Buddha of looking at that, the term nirvana itself, besides being a rock band, the term nirvana, and there is this way that Buddhism is kind of like, I don't know what the word is, but taken over by popular culture.
Mm.
Which is one way, by the way, even though I talk a lot about practice and I'm from a Zen tradition, I'll tend to use the word believer in Buddhism.
Okay.
Because I do think sometimes we in the West, we see Buddhism as this kind of, you know, spiritual path that's not religious. I actually reject that. Buddhism is a religion just like any other religion. Well, different too. But I mean, you know, we have disciplines, we have practices, we have rituals. I think sometimes we miss that. I think we watered Buddhism down in the West, and I lament that. But the idea in rebirth in Buddhism is one of two ways. Some people do see it as a literal phenomenon. And I think Buddhists on the ground, some devotional Buddhists will even see it as a self-continuing, even though that's kind of a no-no topic in Buddhism. The way I see it personally is I see it as a very skillful psychological metaphor. There are these different levels of rebirth that you can kind of ascend in or descend into. If I lose my temper and I'm angry, well, then I'm in the hell realm. If I'm acting out of, you know, mental cravings and attachments and not thinking about how I'm affecting other people, then I'm born in the animal realm. If I'm selflessly giving to other people, maybe I'm holding the hand of a patient who's dying at the hospital, something like that, well, then I'm reborn in one of the God realms. You know, I think our consciousness moves in this kind of ever-shifting state constantly throughout our lives. The two terms sometimes that you used around rebirth from Buddhists are samsara and nirvana. Samsara literally means to journey. To journey. And it's kind of this journey, and I like that a lot. A lot of Western traditions will look at sin as, or suffering as sin, or a mistake, or being far from God, or breaking the law, or something like that. In both Hinduism and Buddhism, there's this idea of suffering is samsara. It's a journey that you're taking, kind of like we were talking about before. It's this, you know, if you're suffering, you're on this inexorable vortex where you're kind of descending and suffering, and everything you cling to causes you to suffer even more. Nirvana, as a term, what that literally means is literally cessation, blowing out. So the Buddha didn't spend a lot of time talking about, you know, how do we define nirvana. What the Buddha said more was teaching practices of how to get there. But the other thing was that the Buddha would only offer some things. Like he would say, nirvana is the cessation of samsara. It's snuffing out that suffering, cyclical state of existence. So you could take rebirth one of two ways. One, if you view life as a, you know, negative thing to be escaped from this cycle of rebirth, then you're liberated from that, like in a literal sense. A lot of Hindu thought is that way. Some Buddhist thought is that way. I actually take it the opposite way. I think life is great. I think life is beautiful. And sometimes there's deep suffering, and what we're doing is trying to liberate ourselves from these suffering states.
Now, the role of karma comes into play, though. I mean, the idea that merits or demerits, that's not the right phrase, but are sort of carried over into the next cycle of life. Is that right? So the idea of karma is still there, just like we looked at in Hinduism.
Yes, and if I can, to be candid, and I think we talked about this in individual dialogues, I think in some ways karma gets defined as this kind of, I don't know how to say it exactly, but this kind of wholly other sense of justice. It's like, you know, you do something in this life, and in the next life, your karma will impact you. I actually think all religions, in one way or shape or another, have this kind of teaching. Like in Christianity, at least in the mythology of Christianity, you know, you have the tree of knowledge, you know, and then you have this original sin that's passed on to all people. I mean, that could be sort of like a traditional Asian view of karma. Karma is a Sanskrit term. It literally means action or deed. That's what the word karma actually means. Action or deed. One of the ways that Buddhism differed from Hinduism is that the Buddha came along and he said, your intentionality is your karma, a very famous passage. So, I mean, Hinduism is arguably the most diverse of all world religions, but so I don't want to pigeonhole Hinduism, but there is this idea that a lot of Hindu, actually until the 1950s, I think that the caste system was still legal, and you know, your present state in existence was due to the karma you had in a past life. The Buddha came along and he said, no, your intentionality is your karma. What you do, I mean, you could see that as a very strong advocate of, say, free will, but it's, you know, what you do in your individual existence, that dictates your karma.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, though.
No, I think I think it's important for folks to understand. You know, I mean, from a as I mentioned last week, and as Girish and I were talking last week, it's quite clear that karma is it's like the law of gravity. I mean,
yeah.
It's, in other words, there's not a being or a group of beings that kind of look upon life and go, you know, second time around for you. You know, I mean, it's It's like the law of gravity. You jump off a 10-story building, you're going to be on the sidewalk in a matter of seconds. You know, I mean, in connection with that, of course, Christianity teaching that there is a personal being that's overseeing the evaluation of life. That personal being also has the opportunity, perhaps, to be, you know, gracious, you know, instead of meeting out justice or something like that as well. But the law of karma, of course, is like the law of gravity. There isn't some sort of decision that's being made at that point. You inherit and you pass along that intentionality from existence to existence is the way I understand it.
I think that's, I really agree with that and like that. The only thing I would add to that is that in a sense, like, you make every decision as a response. Like, one of my wife and I, you know, one of our favorite sayings in our household is, and it's kind of a classic Buddhist saying, is there's causes and conditions for all things. So, for example, there's all kinds of causes and conditions in my life that have probably helped me become Buddhist or work for Hospice Austin or move to Austin and not Dallas or whatever it is. Karma, I think, is actually a great endorsement of human life. Because it's saying that freedom is really within your hands. How will you respond to the inevitabilities that were presented to you, if that makes sense? Karma, in other words, it can mean one of two things. It definitely has this view for a lot of Hindus, some Buddhists, this idea that there's just this kind of divine mechanism in the universe, like gravity. You know, this inexorable force of which you are just a part. And it can carry with you life after life, that sort of thing. I don't view karma that way. I view karma as kind of, and I think this is what the Buddha taught, that there's a moment-to-moment decision-making process in your life to which you are accountable and to which you respond, if that makes sense.
Well, no, I think that does highlight something that is very important in the Buddhist way of understanding things, the Christian way of understanding things, is in the Buddhist way of understanding things, life is your own, decisions are your own, living with the results of those decisions, you know, are your own. I ran across an interesting interview with Bono. Of course, I'm a fanboy of U2, and he had a book called Bono in Conversation by Mitch Gassayas, and in which he contrasted, you know, karma and grace, you know, from his understanding of things. And this may take just a moment to read, but I thought it was a very interesting way of contrasting the two. Isaiah says, I think I'm beginning to understand religion because I've started acting and thinking like a father. What do you make of that? Bono, yes, I think that's normal. It's a mind-blowing concept that the God who created the universe might be looking for company, a real relationship with people. But the thing that keeps me on my knees is the difference between grace and karma. Isaiah, I haven't heard you talk about that. Bono, you see, at the center of all religions is the idea of karma. You know, what you put out comes back to you, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, or in physics and physical laws, every action is met by an equal or opposite one. It's clear to me that karma is at the very heart of the universe. I'm absolutely sure of it. And yet, along comes this idea called grace to upend all that as you reap, you will sow stuff. Grace defies reason and logic. Love interrupts, if you like, the consequences of your actions, which in my case is very good news indeed, because I've done a lot of stupid stuff. Isaias, I'd be interested to hear that. Bono, that's between me and God. But I'd be in big trouble if karma was going to finally be my judge. I'd be in deep, four-letter word. Bono can say it. Baptist preacher can't. He goes on to say, it doesn't excuse my mistakes, but I'm holding out for grace. I'm holding out that Jesus took my sins onto the cross because I know who I am, and I hope I don't have to depend on my own religiosity. Isaias, the Son of God who takes away the sins of the world. I wish I could believe in that. Bono, but I love the idea of the sacrificial lamb. I love the idea that God says, look, you cretins, there are certain results of the way you are, your selfishness. There's a mortality is a part of your very sinful nature. And let's face it, you're not living a very good life, are you? There are consequences to actions. The point of the death of Christ is that Christ took on the sins of the world so that what we put out does not come back to us, that our sinful nature does not reap the obvious death. That's the point. It should keep us humbled. It's not our own good works that gets us through the gates of heaven. I wish I could say that in an Irish accent. So I understand how Bono was putting that, but you know, as a Baptist in particular, I read that and I think, well, that's very interesting. You know, how he how he comes to that contrast between karma and grace, and how grace sort of interrupts that, as, you know, what you sow, you shall reap type of approach to life. Which I guess leads me to, and you and I talked about this, I think, in our very first meeting over at a coffee shop, and that was and this was a few months ago when the item was really hot in the news, but Brit Hume, you know, and Tiger Woods, and of course Tiger with his Buddhist background, and in a kind of a talk show, some folks were asking, well, what does Tiger do now that, you know, this is out, you know, what does he do? And Brit Hume, somebody who kind of fairly recently returned to a commitment to his Christian faith, that had, I think, surprised everybody going around the panel, as different people had said. And he said, well, you know, he said, Buddhism doesn't seem to have the story of forgiveness and redemption that Christianity has. I would encourage Tiger to turn to Christianity. And, of course, the first reaction everybody had was, you know, as I heard one TV reporter say, he's dissed about 1 million Buddhists, you know, by saying that. And my question is, though, and, of course, I'm not here to take up for Brit Hume. He can kind of stand on his own if he wants to. But my question is, Buddhism doesn't have, you know, the story of forgiveness and redemption that Christianity has. I mean, it's answering two different things, I think. I think Hume was simply, you know, pointing that out. At any rate, I think Bono was saying pretty much the same thing Hume was saying. Didn't get near as much trouble as Hume did with, you know, with saying it. But what is a Buddhist leader's reaction to that? And I guess in light of that, here's a Buddhist in the news. What's the way forward for him in Buddhism? You know, Brit Hume, Bono, they give their answer. What's a Buddhist way forward for a Tiger Woods?
You know, this question, other people have asked me this question too, and it's a good one. They said that, you know, if Tiger Woods was to ask your advice, Dave, what would you say? And first off, that's probably not going to happen. but secondly, if I was Tiger's Buddhist priest, what would I say? The first thing is I wouldn't say anything. I'd actually just listen to him. Mm. I'd want to get to know him. Mm. I'd want to know what's going on in his life, why he acted the way he acted. I think my answer to Tiger would in some ways be my answer to any person in any tough situation. I just think as a Buddhist, these things are true. And this kind of gets back to what we were saying earlier. In any circumstance in life, whatever it is you're facing, a serious illness, a great change, a media scandal like Tiger Woods, I think if you're going to follow the true path, whatever your path is, you need a couple key things. One, you do need some kind of belief or philosophy. I won't say belief in the sense that it has to be religion, because even though I'm an ordained religious clergy person, I don't think someone necessarily has to be religious to be happy. But I do think you need something. I think Viktor Frankl was on to something. You do need some kind of philosophy, some principles that will sustain you through your dark night of the soul, or no soul. You know, number two, you even more important perhaps is you need a practice. Meditation, yoga, chanting, contemplative prayer. You know, I was raised in the Catholic Church, the seven sacraments, you know, Zen meditation. But you need some practice to make those ideals that first part of the equation. The second part of the equation is making those ideals, those beliefs lived. The third thing is, you know, it's interesting, too, and this is something we Western Buddhists miss a lot. The Buddha, it's great. Like, if you look at the Buddhist scriptures, rhetorically, they are a lot like the Christian scriptures. Like, you could really say, in some ways, the Christian New Testament. And I love this, rhetorically. You know, the apostles are always asking Jesus questions, and they're always getting stuff wrong. You know, like, they're like, who gets to sit at your right hand? You know, mm-hmm. and all this stuff. And they're just asking the wrong questions. Same in Buddhism. Mm-hmm. Which probably meant, I don't know, Jesus and the Buddha needed to hang out more together. The Buddha's disciples asked him what was the most important thing on the spiritual path, you know, and he put the question back to him, and they said, meditation, no, you know, philosophy, no, rituals, no. The Buddha said, the Sangha, the spiritual community, that is the most important thing on the spiritual path. And so I think for Tiger Woods, I think I don't know him, and so in some ways me trying to throw any advice at him is crazy, but I think that in general, as a Buddhist priest, I think we need those things. We need some philosophy, some means to put that in philosophy and action, and then a community to support us. And I sense that Tiger got away from those things, is my sense. I haven't followed it much, but that's my sense.
Well, David, I appreciate you coming out.
Hey, thank you,
my friend.
Thank
this guy for coming and joining with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. We'll give you a chance to go get some chips and queso now. I've been really looking forward to this particular interview with David. I've just so much enjoyed him as a person, and I hope that that was obvious, you know, as we got a chance to interact with each other up on the platform. I want to mention a few things to you about the resource table in the back, and then we're going to conclude with a word of prayer. And Winfried Corjun has written a book from a Christian perspective called Neighboring Faiths. And, of course, that's where the title from this particular series came from. This would be a useful book for you to just have on your shelf, I think, so that you can refer to it when you are interacting with friends or coworkers or neighbors from another faith tradition. You know, David, you mentioned about maybe Jesus and Buddha needing to get together and interacting. Rabbi Zacharias wrote a book some time ago called The Lotus and the Cross, Jesus Talks with Buddha. And I thought it was just very interesting, sometimes entertaining, sort of interaction, imaginative interaction between Jesus and the Buddha, from a Christian perspective, of course. And David, this is your copy. You and I were talking, and you said you had not had a chance to look at that, so I wanted to get that for
thank
you.
Thank you.
And then also, there's one more book out there, and like I said, I feel like I'm sort of hawking my own wares, but this book is from me. It's called The Anchor Course. And really, I think when we're dealing with other religions, other faiths, it gives us a chance to maybe go back to our own faith and say, but what do I believe about that? Or some of you, you don't come from a Christian background and you want to learn more about Christianity, even as we're trying to learn more about Buddhism tonight. And this book is actually designed for that, to introduce you to sort of the sort of a travel guide to Christianity, if you will. And David, I just went ahead and got a copy of that for you as well. So thank you again for coming out tonight. And let me lead us in a word of prayer, all right? My Heavenly Father, we are so grateful for this chance to get together with my friend David. I pray that you would bless David, that you would bless me with our continuing efforts to understand more about this human experience. I pray that you would help all of us in this room to understand more and more about the human experience, and to understand more and more about that archer behind that occasional poison arrow that we experience sometimes. Lord, I pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you all.